Time once again to take another stroll down history roads in our Loves Me County. Definitely Loves Me County is one Cian Manning. Cian, good to see you.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me again. We're claiming a bit of territory here today.
I like the sound of this already.
People of Carrick-on-Shore, the white and blue, you're very welcome. And the yellow and blue, you'll get used to it in time. So today I said we're looking at John O'Neill. The fantastic thing with technology now is that you can sort of access quite a lot of information that probably wouldn't have been able to before.
So, which is fantastic.
Which is fantastic. So like, for instance, with John O'Neill, where this story kind of originated as regards myself kind of looking at him was I decided to look at what portraits in the National Portrait Gallery in London had Waterford connections. So obviously there was a lot related to lords and earls and marquises and all this sort of stuff. But this name came up, John O'Neill, and it had underneath his profession a shoemaker.
Right.
So there had to be something more to it. So we know that John was born in Waterford around 1777. Some would say 1778. He leaves school at age 9 and he actually decides to become an apprentice shoemaker. So his uncle was a well-known shoemaker in the southeast, and John later settles and marries in Carrick-on-Shore. John always had sort of literary pretensions. He was very much sort of spoke about he was only kind of at peace when he was either reading or writing something. So he decides to kind of give up the shoemaking and make his way to England.
Now this would have been a big move for someone that was, you know, to follow literary pursuit number one and was still a dog and eat dog environment.
Yeah, and very much like you're looking at it probably again looking at the sort of social system that would have been in Ireland at the time, that it was probably being a shoemaker was seen as a very stable income. So it was probably maybe even probably even like frivolous to attempt to do something that obviously had been outside of what his family had been doing for generations, would be fair to say. So like, even to give context to when John went to Liverpool first and then later to London, the historian Liam Hart notes that John O'Neill, as the father of a large impoverished family, his first wife bore him at least 11 children.
My God.
So I think we'll probably have to come back and talk about her more so than John in time. But O'Neill was prone to many physical and psychological privations. This included starvation, pauperism were seldom far from his mind, and he was frequently out of work.
Literally waiting for the phone to ring, if you could say that.
yeah, sort of. It has that kind of like struggling writer
watermark
that we could relate even to Niecy Peterson from a few weeks past. Fair play to John. He continues working as a shoemaker to obviously sort of make a living while pursuing his writing.
Of course, he's a wife, he's a family to look after.
Yeah, but he actually publishes a satire called The Clothier's Looking Glass, which is basically a joke on tailors. So obviously there's some rivalry between shoemakers and tailors that I'm definitely not aware of, but John O'Neill was in the middle of in that period. And it's critically well received, but receives very little attention further afield.
All right.
So it's kind of like this thing that he's written something that is actually really good.
Yes.
But just hasn't...
I'm not making any money out of
it. Exactly. He just hasn't received any of that kind of credit or, more importantly, financial reward. So as I said, O'Neill always saw writing and reading as the chief consolations of life in every extremity. So even when things were going particularly badly, he was always comforted by his, I suppose, his passion for reading and then his pursuit of writing.
Hard to sell that to your wife and family. Well, you know what I mean?
Very much so. Very much so. Mm. But I think John, as well as having this kind of purity of passion, also has a bit of a shrewd streak, particularly in the 1840s, because obviously we have the development of the temperance movement in Ireland and across Britain. And he later notes that one of his great motivations was to promote the ideas and ideals of temperance.
Right.
So
he was obviously a principled individual. And
yeah, so we see a little shift in the topics of his writings. So from the early 19th century, around 1808, he moves to London and he's still shoemaking on the side, but he is prolific as regards writing. So he writes poems, 8 dramas. He releases a novel in 3 volumes called Mary of Avonmore. And he becomes acquainted with the illustrator George Cruikshank. So if anyone is into sort of Charles Dickens and Dickensian things, Cruikshank was a friend of Dickens and did a lot of illustrations of his work.
Right.
And luckily, for those that are interested in print and art and imagery and graphic design, Cruikshank actually did some illustrations for O'Neill's poems. So this includes The Drunkard in 1840, which really is the sort of work that changes his life to a great extent and his recognition as a writer. Another illustrated work by Cruikshank for O'Neill included The Blessings of Temperance in 1851 and The Triumph of Temperance in 1852. And even there's kind of a quid pro quo element to it, as in O'Neill's poem The Drunkard actually inspired Cruikshank's illustrations, The Bottle, which were very popular within, I suppose, Victorian homes of that era. So the Drunkard, for instance, is actually dedicated to Father Matthew, who obviously was a pivotal figure in the Temperance Indeed. Movement. So we believe at one stage there's about 3 million members of it, which would be absolutely huge even by today's standards.
Incredible.
And you think there's...
Are we talking Ireland now?
Yeah, I believe Ireland.
Just Ireland?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So this is all done in the context of, you know, difficulties with transport, no ease of communication.
No social media.
No social media. So this is, you know, as we say, John O'Neill, the laureate of the temperance movement. You can see immediately his kind of status as an author, writer, poet is elevated to kind of a new realm from when he was struggling in Liverpool. The poem itself, The Drunkard, actually opens with the Shakespearean words, "Oh, that a man will put an enemy into his mouth to steal away his brains."
Wow.
So he was sort of laying down his marker as well.
Right away.
Not only about temperance, but also by evoking the bard as well, kind of, again, putting him into a different stratosphere. It's interesting with the passage of time then that what we seem as kind of cool or on trend can appear less trendy. So again, that paper, the Waterford Standard, in 1943 noted it of O'Neill, "Neither the poems nor the dramatic pieces written by John O'Neill bear any high marks of excellence as literary works, but they were once very popular and regarded as having well served the cause of temperance." So, you know, basically maybe alluding to that he was very much of his time, kind of captured a moment in time as well, and maybe in the grand scheme of literary canon, we're probably talking maybe a junior bee hurler made it to Crow Park.
Right.
But just had that brief moment then. So we know at one stage that he was still a shoemaker in Drury Lane. Just before his death, he publishes a work called The Legends of Carrick. It's obviously evoking Carrick on Shore, which was published in 1854. The portrait I referred to at the start is a engraving of what we believe is an original work by Cruikshank, but was then later engraved by Charles Edward Wagstaff. And that was donated to the portrait gallery in London in 1937 by a Mary S. Draper. So she was obviously more aware of the significance or context of it. And we know that John O'Neill died in 1858, but as usually with art and literature and stuff, there was kind of a second life. I'm sure you had a subscription to this magazine. It was called St. Crispin, a magazine for the leather trade.
Oh, definitely.
I think it would probably take on a different context in the 21st century.
Ever so slight.
But it published, it actually serialised John O'Neill's autobiography. So it would have had about 28 chapters altogether. And that was released between 1869 to February 1870.
So was he still a shoemaker up to the end then, or what?
Very much so, yeah. Right. Yeah, I believe.
On Drury Lane.
Yeah.
I wonder, did he know the Muffin Man?
Cobbled many a shoe and many a poem for the Muffin Man.
Yeah, well, there's an interesting one for you now. I have to say, it's a great trade. It's a very interesting trade.
Yeah.
Very ancient trade.
I like the idea of that it's sort of a job to sort of sustain and subsist for something else.
Yeah.
And it's kind of probably nowadays will be seen as a slight weird job. But it reminded me of when I was in college, I needed money and I decided to sign up as a medical role player.
A medical role player?
Yeah.
What does a medical role player do?
So my brother will kill me for telling this story because he's a nurse. But basically for student nurses and doctors to practice on real people.
you basically... donated your body to science while still alive.
I did. And to be fair to them, they were very well organised. I mightn't have been. So you're usually given a slip of paper at the time and it would sort of outline what you are as a patient, in inverted commas. Hmm. And then the student would come in and do their usual checks and all this sort of stuff. So one day I decided not to read the paper. And there must have been 10 or 12 of these poor doctoral students asking me to have any pains in my chest. And of course, in real flat water accent, no, I'm grand. And eventually, when he came to the end of the thing, I looked at the piece of paper and it said that I was a 6'7" African-American basketball player who had just come off a long haul flight from LA complaining of chest pains.
Such perfect casting, really.
So anyone who doesn't know what I look like, I don't look like that. And one of the worst backhanded compliments I ever received from one of the students was when they were going through what signs I exhibited.
Yes.
They said the patient appears to be well nourished.
On that note, I'm sure there's a mug of tea and a blah awaiting somewhere. Thank you so much, Cian Manning.